This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
It's okay, we'll have to deal. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. قال لن أرسله معكم حتى تؤتوني موثقا من الله لتأتنني به إلا أن يحاط بكم. فلما آتوه موثقهم قال الله على ما نقول وكيل. وقال يا بني لا تدخلوا من باب واحد وادخلوا من أبواب متفرقة وما أغني عنكم من الله من شيء إن الحكم إلا لله عليه توكلت وعليه فليتوكل المتوكلون ولما دخلوا من حيث أمرهم أبوهم ما كان يغني عنهم من الله من شيء إلا حاجة في نفس يعقوب قضاها وإنه لذو علم علمناه ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون. رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. فالحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. أما بعد, once again everybody, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله تعالى وبركاته. So today I'm going to try to take on the task of discussing some things from ayahs number 66 all the way to 68 with you guys. This is now the response of Yaqub alayhi salam when his sons told him that they've made up their minds and they're going to take Binyamin, who has not been mentioned by name, the youngest brother. They're going to take him and they're going to get that, you know, year's worth of load, that kail. It's kailun yasir, it's an easy load. There's no way they're turning that down. So they basically disregarded their father's concern of the previous statement. Now the father is desperate and he's going to try to, he recognizes that there's no way he can stop them. So in the weak position that he's in, where they're not regarding his authority on this issue, he's going to plead with them and he's going to basically say, I'm not going to let him go until you do this, this, and this. Now, I need to give you a little bit of a disclaimer about these three ayat. What I'm going to do in this session is explain to you the basic lessons from this ayah as I understand them, as I've been trying to do with other ayat too. But there is something about these ayat that has been a very big subject of discussion in tafsir history and in our tradition that has to do with the evil eye. So that's a subject in the in Islamic tradition, and many Muslims are familiar with it. You know, Desis call it nazar, right? Or nazar in the Arabic language. But like it comes from a famous hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, al-aynu haqq. Now, before we get into that subject, and I'll kind of bring up where that applies, before I talk about that, I want to just give you guys some transparency. This is a subject which isn't explicitly mentioned in the Quran anywhere. There are places that are used for istidlal, for drawing evidence of its existence in the Quran. But it's not actually directly spelled out as a reality anywhere in the Quran. Not in the way that some people claim. That's actually not true. There are narrations, several of them, around this. And the early interpretation of this ayah, particularly among the Tabi'in generation onwards, is very popular that this, what we're going to read today, has to do with the evil eye. So that is a very, very popular and a very common, to the point where it became the standard interpretation of these ayat. There are other ways of looking at this ayah, and even as early as Ibrahim al-Nakhai, there were alternative views of the same ayah that I'm going to discuss. Now it's kind of weird for me to talk to you about different points of view when I haven't even discussed the ayah with you yet. So what different points of view about what? I'll come to that in a minute, or in a few minutes when we get to that part of the discussion. But what I will tell you as part of my transparency with you is that I'm going to share what I've come to understand of these ayat, the lesson to be drawn from these ayat, but the larger subject of the evil eye and how to understand that, I think it's a relevant subject because it has been associated with the Quran. And it affects many Muslims, and many Muslims think a certain way. Hey, don't dress like that. You're going to get the evil eye, or you're going to go to the wedding. You better, you know, read something and blow on yourself or something like that, because you're going to get the evil eye. So it's a big part of our cultures, and it's something that's kind of, it's part of the Islam of many people in one way or the other. And I'm not refuting it. I'm not accepting it. I'm saying that it's something that deserves a deeper look,
right? So for that, I must admit that I don't have the qualifications or the research really to engage in that study. So I'm going to try to look for a scholar or two in the next day or so that I can have an intelligent conversation with as a seeker, as someone who knows the narrations, as someone who's read about this subject before, knows perhaps maybe only a little bit more than the average Muslim listening to this knows about the evil eye and how that works. I mean, we've all heard some things about it growing up as Muslims, and we know a thing or two, right? So I want to kind of wrap my head around it for myself and have a conversation about how to understand the framework of this subject with somebody. And as soon as I secure that conversation and set that appointment, I'm going to make that a live session also. And depending on how it's structured, I might even open up the opportunity for you guys to ask your questions about that topic, collect them, and then have a follow-up session on the subject before moving on to other ayat. But let's come back to the surah at hand, and let's come back to these ayat at hand. So, قَالَ لَنْ أُرْسِلَهُ مَعَكُمْ. Now, Yaqub is speaking to his sons who say, we're taking Binyamin and going. He says, I will not send him with you. It's, yeah, I want you to almost like imagine, not that I know this happened, but it's almost as if he's standing at the door. You're not going anywhere until you do this. Do what? حَتَّى تُؤْتُونِي مَوْثِقًا مِّنَ اللَّهِ. Until you give me a covenant. A covenant means a sacred promise, a binding promise from Allah. Now, this from Allah is a little bit confusing because that sounds weird in English. Give me a promise from Allah. مِنْ هُنَا لِلْإِبْتِدَى. It's originating from Allah, meaning when you make this promise, you have to understand that this, the validity and the weight of this promise comes from Allah. In other words, we swear by Allah that we're going to do so and so and so. And Allah is the witness, and Allah is making this word of ours sacred. So it's not, I give you my word. I give you my word with Allah as witness and Allah as guarantor that I am going to fulfill my word. So if I break this agreement, I haven't just committed a crime against you, I've committed a crime against Allah. So this is a pretty heavy demand that Yaqub alayhi salam is making of his sons. And it's important to note that he didn't make such a demand before. So why now? The way you can understand this is he's powerless at this point. But he also, as much as he's worried about them and he doesn't like what they do and doesn't trust them, they're still his sons. So he's still concerned for their well-being. But now it's come to the point where the only way he can have any hope that they will do as they say is if they have any ounce of faith in Allah left in them, I'm going to hold on to that as my guarantee. I have nothing else to hold on to. But you know, by saying that, he's also put their akhirah, their afterlife at risk, right? Because if they break this promise, obviously it's sinful, but now it's blasphemous if they break this. So, and that's his way of securing they're not going to do this. It's a desperate measure by him to at least give me this promise. Give me something at least. Give me, because I can't just let you go without having some reassurance, because he knows what it felt like when his sons left with one of his beloved children and never came back with him and came back with a story. And then they tried to convince him afterwards. And he doesn't want to go through that again. So before you come back and try to convince me, you must convince me already that you won't be lying. So before a lie happens and then you have to make up a story, before any of that happens, I'm going to preempt that because I have that experience already. And I'm going to tell you, you need to take an oath by Allah that you will. And then what's that oath by Allah? Or emanating from Allah himself? لَتَأْتُنَّنِي بِهِ. That you will absolutely bring him back to me. You will absolutely bring him back to me. That's going to happen. You're not giving me some wolf story this time. I don't want to hear anything. And then he says, إِلَّا أَن يُحَاطَ بِكُمْ. The only scenario in which I will accept that you came back without him is if you all got surrounded. Unless all of you got surrounded. What does that mean, all of you got surrounded? You know, ironically, wolves hunt in packs. And wolves surround their prey. Wolves can even take down a lion. Because the lion goes after one and the others attack from behind and they exhaust the lion until he dies, right? But interestingly, before the metaphor was they were the wolves that one should be afraid of. But now they're the ones that should be afraid of being surrounded and being preyed on. Why? Let's set the scene. You have a difficult time in the region, between countries even. People are starving. When the economy tanks, crime goes up. And when people are traveling unarmed, are traveling and it looks like they've got money on them. And especially now, listen to this, do you understand this? They just came back And they came back with a load of stuff. They could have gotten robbed on the way, right? On the way back. Because on the way there, they don't look like they're carrying much. So nobody knows the purpose of their travel, right? But on the way back, clearly, they've got bags and bags of stuff. So they've got something to be robbed about. Now, people who see them pass by, a day or two later, they're going to see them. Now, you shouldn't see those people again for a year. But they're going to go hit that road again in a day or two, right? And so people with an evil intent, like, wait, these guys are making some kind of money because they went empty-handed, I remember. And then a week later, they're coming back, loads of bags. They're going back, looks like empty-handed. I bet they have money on them. I bet they have something I could rob. So it is a dangerous situation to take the same road and go back again. And Yaqub alayhi salam has a sense to know, listen, I understand that the roads are dangerous. The only situation, the only scenario in which he's not coming back to me is all of you got surrounded and killed. All of you got robbed. All of you got taken hostage. None of you made it. I won't accept that the robbers came and just took him and all of you escaped somehow. How's that a scenario? So he's basically saying, unless you all get, yuhata bikum has been interpreted classically also as to be surrounded, also can mean to be surrounded for destruction. And you know, Quran even uses this phrase, not just for people, but uhita bi thamarihi, right? That his fruit was surrounded, meaning a storm surrounded it and it destroyed his garden. That's how the phrase is used elsewhere in the Quran. So the idea, unless you get run over, unless you get robbed or you get ambushed and get killed, that's the only scenario in which I'll understand that you didn't come back with him. And that's the only justification I'll accept. And yuhata bikum can also mean in a more general sense, unless you are overrun or taken hostage or, you know, something like that. So, but in that case, it's not you're not coming back with him. Nobody's coming back. None of you are going to survive that, right? So, and yuhata bikum. So now they heard this from their father and they're like, oh, just let him get off our case. فَلَمَّا أَتَوْهُ مَوْثِقَهُمْ. And when they finally gave him their covenant, meaning they gave him their word from Allah, we swear by Allah, we won't do this. And the lamma, usually the word lamma, which I'm translating as when they did it. You notice that when I translated, I said when they finally did it or when it was all done. The reason I say that is lamma is for tarahi. So it's different from idha or hina. Lamma means after a while, which could suggest that Yaqub alayhi salam had them literally spell out. You know how you have nowadays, no, raise your hand and say this, repeat after me. Not just, you better promise, you better swear by Allah, you're going to do this, yeah, we will. No, that's not good enough. Say it. Say it word for word. Say it three times, something. There was an actual ritual, an actual ceremony kind of process by which he had them commit to this oath before he let them go. Now, there is something to be said about the effect of that statement. I mean, there's no way he can hold them to that. Once they leave the house, they can do whatever they want, right? But there is something to be said about the human conscience and something to be said about no matter how messed up you think someone is, when you have them give their word and they spell it out, they look at you in the face and they swear by Allah and they spell it out, there may be something in them at that moment. Hold on, that's my phone's adhan thing. Okay. So, you know, at that moment, it might be that their conscience kicks in. And even when they're inclined to do the wrong thing, that might come in their head. You shouldn't take the power of the human conscience for granted. Even for people that are messed up, it can wake up at any moment, right? So you're giving them, you're planting a seed. You may not see its effects right away, but it might activate at any time. Right, it might just turn on, that switch might just turn on because of this experience. And you never know when that can happen. And this is important because these kinds of conversations, when you spell something out to someone or you make them understand the seriousness of something, and you turn it into this kind of very rigid, you know, you're going to say this exactly as I want you to. I need you to repeat exactly after me. No, take this seriously. And until he sees that they're taking it seriously and they're not just rolling their eyes, he's not letting them go. He's giving them a hard time. So when they finally did it, mawthiqahum, when they did their part, then he says, قَالَ اللَّهُ عَلَى مَا نَقُولُ وَكِيلٌ. He says, Allah is overseeing and Allah is the disposer over everything that we're saying, meaning the guarantor, the one who we will rely on over this agreement that we've made, isn't me. I can't enforce it. The one who will enforce it is Allah. And the one who will deal with the consequences of you breaking it is Allah is watching this. By the way, an interesting parallel, again, with the story of Yusuf alayhi salam that I didn't notice before. That just came to me now in Surah Al-Qasas, when Musa alayhi salam was getting married and he met with the girl's father. And the father said, you could work for me 8 years, or if you want to do 10, it's up to you. And they made an agreement. هَذَا مَا بَيْنِي وَبَيْنَكَ سَأُنَبِّكُ So he says, أَيَّمَ الْأَجَلَيْنِ قَضَيْتْ فَلَا عُدْوَنَ عَلَيَّ. Either one. If I do 8 years or 10 years, you can't hate on me. If after 8 years I want to go, I'm free to go. If after 10 years I want to go, I'm free to go. Right? And he says, Wallahu alama naqulu wakil. Same words. And Allah is going to dispose over this agreement that we've made. The true witness and the guarantor over our statement is Allah Azza wa Jal. The word wakil is similar to the word we use, same origin as the word tawakkul. So we say, وَعَلَى اللَّهِ فَلْيَتَوَكَّلِ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ, that upon believers, upon Allah, believers exclusively place their trust, or we rely on Allah. So the word wakil is the one to rely on. That's the word, that's what the word means. So Allah is the one to rely on over what we're saying, the guarantor over what we're saying. So he says this, again reminding them, you don't respect my authority. My desperate hope is you will have some recognition of the authority of Allah Azza wa Jal. So that's really his last plea. And you should not underestimate the power of that. Whether or not that will come true or not, you will see that actually one of the brothers did it hit him. Later on, he's going to say, I took an oath with our dad. And he remembers the sacred nature of that oath, which compels him to do everything he can to retrieve Binyamin. But that's later on in the story. Now we get to the part that's been, the commentary around it is basically, it's singular. Like there's one kind of commentary for the most part about this, but I have an alternative view on this. Wallahu ta'ala alam. And again, I will do more research on the subject, but I'll share with you as I best understand it. He says, وَقَالَ, and Yaqub further went. So they've agreed, they've taken the oath. He's a little bit more comforted. But he's not just worried about the security of him. He's worried about the security of all of them. And by the way, if they get hurt, he automatically gets hurt anyway, right? Because they're traveling as a pack. And if he's traveling alone, obviously he's going to get attacked. He's far more susceptible to being attacked. So Yaqub alayhi salam, being concerned about the safety of all of his children, says, وَقَالَ يَا بُنَيَّ لَا تَدْخُلُوا مِنْ بَابٍ وَاحِدٍ. He said, my young children, my beloved sons, بُنَيَّ is ism تَصْغِيرٍ. And it can be used for not just my little sons or my young sons, but my beloved sons. So it's a term of endearment. So he's now lovingly speaking to his sons. And he says, لَا تَدْخُلُوا مِنْ بَابٍ وَاحِدٍ. Don't enter from a single gate. You know, ancient cities, those of you guys that are gamers, like Assassin's Creed style, ancient cities with giant walls and then big gates, and the horses and carriages go through those gates. You can't just enter the city, just waltz in. Because a city was a giant fort back in the day. That was their security system, right? So there's, unless you're living on an island or something like that, the naval protection is there. But if you're landlocked, then they would build these giant walls around cities. So you wouldn't be able to, they're tall enough that you can't scale them. And if enemies are attacking, archers are placed around, or they throw down tar and things like that. And those giant gates that can be closed, that can't be broken, right? So that's the trade. And that's basically your border checkpoints, those gates. Right, that's how you officially enter the state, and the soldiers can stop you and check you and frisk you or whatever they can do at that time, and check your luggage and what you're bringing in, what's your purpose, etc., etc. Right, so those are the ancient gates of a city. Now he says, don't enter from a single gate. So his 11 sons, he tells them, don't come in from one gate. And then what does he say? وَادْخُلُوا مِنْ أَبْوَابٍ مُتَفَرِّقَةٍ, and enter from varying gates that are apart from each other. So don't look like you're coming in as one group. Go in small number and come in from different, different gates. Now the question is, why did he say that? And before I go any further, why in the world did he say that? So the most common interpretation of that is that, you know, his sons were very good looking, and they were, you know, foreigners, and it seemed like they were in the, you know, on the good side of the king, or the king's assistant, meaning, you know, Yusuf alayhi salam. So there was a lot of people that were jealous of them, or could have looked at them with jealousy. They would have been the subject of the evil eye. So they were good candidates for the evil eye catching them, somebody being jealous of them or looking at them in this way. And Yaqub alayhi salam wanted to protect them from the evil eye. So he told them to go from different gates, right? And that's, Again, that's a classical opinion that's found among the tabi'een. We'll discuss that when I have that conversation, you know, with a scholar or two. We'll get to that. But I'll share with you my view on the subject that is just not, if not more, plausible. Wallahu ta'ala alam. So my view on this is, they have come and gone to Egypt in quick succession. And because of the situation of high crime, or, you know, even Yusuf alayhi salam is making sure everybody's bags are loaded in front of his eyes. What does that tell you? That it's a high crime kind of environment, and he needs to make sure that, you know, things are going as they're supposed to go, right? So, because people can steal from within the government administration, outside, any kind of crimes can happen, right? And that's why he's offering hospitality to foreigners that are coming, because he knows the risk they're under if they come and they're not under protection. Like in ancient Arabia, for example, tribes people were safe, but foreigners would get treated poorly. And early Islam, the only Sahaba that got tortured in early Islam were either ones that didn't have a halif, right? Didn't, or they, either they were slaves or they were foreigners to the tribe, and they could be, or, you know, that's how they could be treated. So he understands that, but now look at it from someone who may have a criminal mentality point of view. Why would we have to keep a criminal mentality in mind? Yaqub alayhi salam has already expressed that you might get surrounded. So he's aware of a criminal element on the roads or on the way there. And if they see them going and coming back and going again, that's the same group we saw the other day, right? Oh man, they must be loaded. And even if they see you go into Egypt, they're waiting for you to come back out of Egypt with big bags, right? That's, if you go all together, they'll recognize that you are a good score for us. And when you go through that narrow passage, or you go through that vulnerable spot or that quiet area, that's when we'll hit them. So you might not get attacked when you walk in, but you'll have people scouting you, walking behind you, trailing you, and finding the right opportunity to get to you. So you need to not look like the group that you just went in. And also, you had a case in front of the king, and the king took special interest in you and had this conversation with, or the king's assistant, Yusuf alayhi salam. So maybe they've even become famous. Now they're known. I don't want unnecessary attention on you guys. Just go from separate gates. So he's taking this kind of precautionary measure that Yaqub can think of, how else can I keep them from being safe? And I would think that this interpretation is in line with his earlier condition: you will bring him back unless you get surrounded, right? So if there's that many of you, so what you got going on? They could run into any kind of trouble because they are sticking out too much. Then the question arises, why didn't he give them this kind of a precaution the first time they went? Right? He's saying this the second time, but he didn't say this the first time. And to my understanding, Allahu A'lam, this is entirely theoretical. Possibly because the first time, nobody knew that they come and leave with a load, with a full load. Nobody knows that these are, you know, they're going to go back successful. But the second time they're coming in, everybody in Egypt knows the case. Or a lot of people know the case. Even corrupt cops might want to try to follow them. It's the same 11, it's the same, or same 10, or whoever else. But if they're going separately, it doesn't raise an eyebrow. So it's actually the second time around, they're at more risk than the first time because of the case that transpired. So anyway, Yusuf, you know, Yaqub alayhi salam says this to them and says, "Don't, you know, my beloved sons, don't enter from a single gate, enter from different gates. وَمَا أُغْنِي عَنْكُم مِّنَ اللَّهِ مِنْ شَيْءٍ. And I cannot benefit you against Allah, or from Allah in any way, shape, or form." In other words, I cannot make you independent of Allah's plan. Even this thing that I'm telling you to take extra precaution doesn't mean that if Allah intends harm will come your way, that because of this harm will not come your way. So now we've got two, in a philosophical sense, we've got ourselves a pretty big statement here. He wants to take whatever measures he can, while recognizing that his measures are not the reason they will be safe. That can only come from Allah. If you guys do well, it's not because I told you to go in from multiple doors and that's why you guys were safe. I know that you will never be independent of the need of Allah. Your safety will come from Allah. You will always be in need of Allah providing you safety. But if Allah is the one providing safety, then why do you have to go from multiple doors anyway? And that's the balance of Islam. That's the wisdom of prophets. The wisdom is, you do whatever you can in the world of cause and effect. You stay within the speed limit. You drive on the right side of the road. You make sure you wear a mask. You make sure you take whatever precautions. You make sure before the tooth gets further infected, you go see a dentist. You do your part. But you're not going to get healed because you went to the dentist. The healing will come from Allah Azza wa Jal. There's two things. I don't become, the basic principle in our religion is I don't become successful because I worked hard. I become successful because Allah allowed me to. But that's not the whole picture. Because if I stop at that point, then somebody could say, well, then why do I even have to work hard? Allah will allow me to or not allow me to. That's entirely up to Allah. But Allah has a principle. What's Allah's principle? Show me your effort, I'll grant you the results. The results don't come from us. The only thing that can come from us is the effort. And the results can only come from Allah. Now, there are two extremes. Understand this. Now, let's use those words. Efforts and results. Some people say the results are with Allah. Why even bother with the effort? Allah's going to protect me. So I'm just going to go and do whatever because, you know, it's, you know, I'm going to go to the beach or I'm going to go wherever where there's a large crowd because I have to do da'wah or something. And I'm not going to put a mask on. The angels are my mask and they're going to protect me. And I leave the results in Allah. And some people are even silly enough to say, no, we shouldn't. We should still hold Jum'ah. And if you get sick, then this is a blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You sacrifice for the sake of Allah. No, our religion doesn't tell us to put ourselves in harm's way. It doesn't do that. That's not our religion. That doesn't make any sense, you know. And, you know, there were times where Umar bin al-Khattab, when in case of like a pandemic, like a widespread disease, a lethal disease, he ordered a quarantine and people to flee, those who weren't infected to flee, to stay away. And he was told, how are you, are we running from the Qadr of Allah? And he said, don't you know, we run from the Qadr of Allah. We run from Allah's decree to Allah's decree. What a wise thing to say. And that's really, in essence, how we understand how things work in our religion. I am responsible for doing everything I can within my limited capacity. Whatever I can. And then whether or not that will work will come from Allah. The results are from Allah. So he says, I want you to go from different doors because that's at least one precaution I can think of. But whether or not that precaution will be enough to save you or not save you, that's up to Allah. This is not a substitute for the result of your safety coming from Allah. Effort from us, result from Allah. Now, one group says results are from Allah, why bother with the effort? The other group says, my results are only a product of my effort. I worked hard, therefore my business is successful. We came from different doors, that's why nobody robbed us. We took these precautions, and that's why we were successful. You understand? People will say, what's the secret behind your success? Well, I followed the following four principles, and therefore I became successful, etc. You followed those four principles, but there's a million other people who followed those four principles a lot better than you, but Allah decided not to give them results. Right? So Allah expects from us effort, and then Allah provides results. Now, the thing is, though, Allah will not give you results if you refuse to make effort. He put a need inside the human being to make effort. It's in our nature. Allah is Ar-Razzaq. Think about it this way. Allah is Ar-Razzaq, the provider. So every piece of food I eat, every little bit of oxygen that goes in my lungs is being provided by Allah. I didn't provide it, Allah provides it. The fruit that I eat, the bread that I eat, the meat that I eat, the water that I drink, all of it is coming directly from Allah Azza wa Jal. But do human beings go out in the morning and go do work and make a living and then go to the groceries and buy the groceries, or they expect Allah to deliver? Humanity can't survive if they don't make effort, right? Allah is the provider for every bird. So does it not have to leave its nest and the worm will come to the nest? Or does it have to go out there and find? The nature, the way Allah provides is that He created all of nature, all living things have to go make an effort. And then Allah provides. Then they make an effort, and then Allah provides, right? That's the same idea of effort and result. And so Yaqub alayhi salam is saying, even though I want you to do this, I need you to understand that this does not mean that the result won't come from Allah. I can't make you independent of the need of Allah in any way, shape, or form. In al-hukmu illa lillah, the final verdict, the decision in the end, And the command in the end rests exclusively with Allah, with no one else. عَلَيْهِ تَوَكَّلْتُ On Him alone do I place my trust. I trust Him alone. In other words, me telling you this doesn't mean I trust my instincts or I trust this strategy. But I trust Allah alone. وَعَلَيْهِ فَلْيَتَوَكَّلِ الْمُتَوَكِّلُونَ And any who are actually truly going to place trust should only place their trust in Him. That's the statement he made to them about trusting and relying in, relying on Allah. Now, it's important because if you look at it from the other point of view, which we'll discuss in a later session about, you know, the evil eye. I don't want you to catch the evil eye. Well, but this precaution,
if you do it to this precaution, does not make you safe from the evil eye. What the only safety you get is from Allah at the end of the day. Don't draw unnecessary attention to yourself. Don't become the object of somebody else's jealousy. Don't become so out in the open and so exposing of the blessings that you may have. Don't do that to put yourself out there so people can have thoughts about you, jealousy about you, evil intentions towards you, et cetera, et cetera. We don't know where that may lead. But even if you did take all those precautions, understand that it's not because you don't put yourself out there that you're safe. Your safety still comes only from Allah. وَعَلَيْهِ فَلْيَتَوَكَّلِ الْمُتَوَكِّلُونَ وَلَمَّا دَخَلُوا مِنْ حَيْثُ أَمَرَهُمْ أَبُوهُمْ And when they finally entered from where their dad had told them to, in other words, they listened to father's instructions, right? And they came in from different gates. Now, this also to me seems to further the idea that not only do they have some reliance in Allah and some trust in their father, but the advice their father gave made practical sense to them too, not just spiritual sense that will catch the evil eye. It made practical sense to them. Otherwise, they were pretty dismissive of dad all along so far. So they've had plenty of occasions where they've been dismissive, right? Is everything okay? Has changed? Is the mic still... Yeah? You want to double check before I continue? Should be okay, inshallah. I'll continue. Now, وَلَمَّا دَخَلُوا مِنْ حَيْثُ أَمَرَهُمْ أَبُوهُمْ When they came in from where their dad had told them to. Meaning they came from different gates, right? Allah says, مَا كَانَ يُغْنِي عَنْهُمْ مِنَ اللَّهِ مِنْ شَيْءٍ This was not going to make them independent of Allah in any way, shape, or form. Even though they came in from different gates, this wasn't going to change their fate as far as Allah is concerned. إِلَّا حَاجَةً فِي نَفْسِ يَعْقُوبَ قَضَاهَا Except this was a need inside Yusuf's own self that he had to fulfill. He fulfilled a need. He did away with a need that he had inside him. A need to what? Take precaution. Okay? Now, this might seem like at face value, Allah is saying, even though they came from different gates, that wasn't going to change anything. My plan is my plan. Right, and this wasn't going to make them independent of Allah. And by the way, ما كان يغني عنهم من الله من شيء is something Yaqub already said. Yaqub in the previous ayah already said, عليه السلام, وما أغني عنكم من الله من شيء. So this is Allah is echoing the words of Yaqub عليه السلام. He's agreeing with Yaqub عليه السلام. So first of all, and you need to get out of your head that he's correcting Yaqub عليه السلام, because Yaqub عليه السلام is saying exactly what Allah is saying. And if Allah is repeating the words of Yaqub alayhi salam, he's in sync with Yaqub alayhi salam. But then he's explaining why did Yaqub want them to go through different doors. He says because this was a need Yaqub felt inside of himself. Now what kind of need is that? It's an emotional need to make sure we take every precaution we can. I'll feel uneasy if I don't give you some instructions about being careful. It's as simple as if your son is going to take a travel somewhere for college or university, and clearly once they get on that plane or they get on that train or whatever, then you have no control over what they do, right? But you, as you're leaving, you say, "Be careful, don't stay up late, make sure you make good kinds of friends, etc." You're saying all of those things. The mother feels the need to say that, right? It's a need. Now, where did that need come from? Allah put the need for food, Allah put the need for drink, Allah put the need for shelter, Allah put emotional needs inside of us. These are needs Allah created. They're not needs that we invented. We can't even help it. You know, in English, there's an axiom, you can't grow outside your skin. There are some things that we are created with and we can never say, oh, I don't need that anymore. We have it in us. We a human being has a need to feel loved. A human being has a need to feel connection. A human being has a need to feel safe. A human being has a need to feel understood or a need to feel respect. We have these needs. We can't help it. Like it's inside of us. Just like there's a need to drink and to eat or whatever. He has a need to protect his children. That there's a need inside him. And he fulfilled that need with whatever means he could. That doesn't mean it's the, ma'adallah, that it's the ranting of an old man. Like, you know how they said, inna abana lafi dhalalim mubin, our dad is just lost. This isn't a rant. This is an actual need that he fulfilled. And Allah saying that is Allah not trivializing what Yaqub alayhi salam did. In fact, Allah is acknowledging that this is a need that Allah created. And it's so powerful that even a prophet will feel it. Just because you're in a higher spiritual place doesn't mean you don't feel this need. Oh, somebody has so much iman, they just trust in Allah and they don't say anything. No, I need you to go through different gates. Just take whatever precaution you can. Why would he even say that? Because, you know, the famous axiom that all of you are familiar with, tie your camel and then trust in Allah. Right? That's what this is. But that need, the tying of the camel is a need. If you left your car unlocked outside and you went into a restaurant and you remembered, you're not going to say, oh, Allah is, wa'ala Allahi falyatawakkal al-mu'minun. You know, it'll be outside. You know how I can guarantee the car will still be there? I'm just going to, and the keys are still in the car. I'll just make dua to Allah. Ya Allah, I really need this car. But I also really need to finish this sandwich before it gets cold. So I'm going to eat the sandwich and make sure the car is still there. Ya Rab. Ameen. That's not how that works. There's a need, you have to go and get the keys. And thank Allah that nobody robbed anything from your car. You left your laptop in the car. You left your stuff in the car. You know? So here, Allah acknowledges the human need to want to protect. Allah acknowledges the human need to take whatever precaution. Allah acknowledges the human need of a parent to even try to protect his adult children, who are actually better at protecting the parent than the parent is at protecting them. Physically, they're the ones that are strong, right? But a human need doesn't go away. And he acknowledges, Allah Azza wa Jalla on the one hand, beautifully describes this lovingly describes this need. They weren't going to benefit from going from different gates against Allah's plan in any way. But this was a need that Yaqub had and he fulfilled it. And then Allah, and if you would think that Allah Azza wa Jalla is talking down about Yaqub, like he had this silly need, right? Look at what Allah says about Yaqub immediately after. وَإِنَّهُ لَذُو عِلْمٍ عَلَّمْنَاهُ. And he certainly is a possessor of remarkable knowledge, لِمَا عَلَّمْنَاهُ, of, in regards to what we taught him. He's remarkably knowledgeable in revelation. He's remarkably knowledgeable in trusting Allah, in reliance in Allah. He's a possessor of profound knowledge. And so what is his profound knowledge if he's just fulfilling a need? Now Allah is telling us two dimensions. You can have knowledge of faith. You can have profound knowledge from Allah Azza wa Jal, but that doesn't erase your human needs, your human emotional needs. They both coexist. And Allah allows for both of them to coexist. And he is talking about a man that he gives such an accolade to. Allah has praised Yaqub alayhi salam in such a profound, beautiful way. What does that tell you and me about Yaqub alayhi salam? That he's an example for how to live a life of faith. So even this thing that he did is not a lack of faith. It's not a lack of faith. That's why Allah echoed his words and said this was a need. And this, if it's a need of Yaqub, it'll be your need and my need. Well, we're going to want to be protective. We're going to want to say things that, and the sons might even dismiss it at first. But thankfully, they listened to him. And even though they listened to him, Allah says, yes, they listened to him, but the real reason for their protection was me. That was the real reason, right? And all of it, at the end, this whole conversation starts with what? Yaqub alayhi salam not wanting bin Yamin to be lost in Egypt. I want you to come back with him, right? So they listen to his precaution. They do as he says. They protect their brother, and he's still going to lose bin Yamin. He's still going to lose him. So you do everything you can, but Allah sometimes has his own plan. And from Allah's point of view, that's exactly what Yaqub needs. But from Yaqub alayhi salam's point of view, that's not what he needed at all. It's extremely upsetting. So Binyamin staying back is the best thing that happened for this family. But Binyamin staying back feels like the worst thing that happened to Yaqub, doesn't it? And he's going to trust in Allah again when that happens. So it's, you understand the different perspectives that are happening here, different perspectives that are taking place. So illa hajatan fi nafsi Yusufa qadaha. Nafs is also interesting because nafs can be a term in the Quran and in classical Arabic for the emotional dimension of a human being. Right? So the nafs has been used in this surah quite a bit. Like, inna nafsa la ammaratun bisu wa ma ubarri'u nafsi. Right? I don't consider my nafs innocent. The nafs commands you to do evil. Remember that whole conversation? There's a part of ourselves. So there's a part of ourselves that has emotional needs. And he fulfilled that need by telling his children to protect themselves. وَلَكِنَّ أَكْثَرَ النَّاسِ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ. However, most people have no knowledge. This is how Allah ends this statement. However, most people don't have knowledge. What's the relevance of this statement? You see, most people, either if they follow us, you know, they don't want to get an evil eye, or they want to follow some kind of superstition, or they want to take some protective measures, then they trust their protective measures. Or they say, man, I even read Ayatul Kursi before I left the house, and I even put like a little mini Quran thing hanging from the rear view mirror, and I still got in a car accident. Why did you do this, Ya Allah? I had insurance, spiritual insurance on the car. I did the dua and I recited my quls and everything else at night, and at nighttime I still got an upset stomach. How come, Ya Rab? In other words, most people don't understand that these things are not a guarantee that you are dictating to Allah how things are going to go. You are requesting Allah's protection. But Allah may have His own plans. You still do your part. You will still do your part. And then on the other hand, people think their precautions or their measures are the only ones that protect them. And so, and on the other hand, on the other extreme are people who believe that their faith in Allah alone will protect them. They don't have to take any precautions. Most people don't know how to balance both of those things. Most people don't know. وَلَكِنَّ أَكْثَرَ النَّاسِ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ. But he's a remarkable example of taking care of his emotional needs and not being confused that being close to Allah doesn't deprive him of that. That it's not an act of tawakkul in Allah. Like, if somebody could say, why do you want us to go from different doors? Don't you trust Allah? Allah won't protect? And what does he himself say? Go from different doors. I can't benefit you against Allah's plan. The decision in the end rests only with Allah. On him alone I rely. And anyone who relies should only rely on him. Those are all words of Yaqub Aleyhisselam right after he said it. Now some people interpreted this to mean, first he said go from different doors, then he realized how wrong that was, and then he retracted by saying these things about Allah. I don't read it that way. I would read it as, I'm telling you to take this precaution, knowing that this precaution is only part of the process of my relationship with Allah. He expects for me to fulfill my needs, and I'm doing that. He gave me those needs for a reason, and to do whatever I can. This is the same reason Musa's mother told her daughter to follow Musa. There's no logical explanation except I'll do whatever I can. I'll do something. I can't just sit here and do nothing. I'll do something. And that something turned into Allah's plan. Her walking along the bank of the river was the plan for Egypt, the Egyptian empire, the Pharaoh's empire to fall. If she didn't follow along, then the empire would never crash. None of that would have happened. And Musa alayhi salam wouldn't be alive, because the only reason he's alive is because he drank the milk. And the only reason he drank the milk, because he was refusing the milk of any other woman, is because that girl was outside pointing them back to his mom. Right? So none of that would have happened if the mom didn't say, go follow him. She did whatever she could. Sometimes what we do, and what we're, by contrast, but this is another interesting contrast with the story of Musa alayhi salam. Sometimes a person does whatever they can, and Allah makes that part of Allah's plan in ways we can't even imagine. And sometimes we do whatever we can, and Allah says, but that wasn't going to change anything. You see that, the contrast? So there, that woman, that mother, radiallahu anha, did whatever she could, and that became part of the divine plan. And here, they did whatever they could following their dad's instruction. And Allah says, but that wasn't part of my plan. That wasn't going to change anything. Like, so you've got two different views, and that balances our picture. Allah will decide what He will incorporate into His plan and what He will not. But a need that human beings have is the same need this father had, the same need that mother had to send their kids out to be safe, to look out for safety. The need is the same, actually. The psychology behind it is exactly the same. So this is actually a recognition in the Quran for that dimension. And this is an important thing to say, because And I'll conclude today's conversation with this. Inshallah, we'll deal with the evil eye as soon as we can. If I can do this tomorrow, I will. If not, then I'll let you guys know on Facebook when I can, inshallah. But what I want to talk to you about is, you know, us human beings, we're wired with multiple kinds of needs, right? So let me just put this out to you guys so you can understand this in a maybe bird's eye view. So Allah created us with physical needs, food, shelter, procreation, etc. Those are physical needs, like animals have. We have them, animals have them. Then Allah created us with spiritual needs, a need to connect with a higher purpose. He put a ruh inside us that is seeking that higher purpose. Those are spiritual needs. It's a need to find truth, the need to be grateful, the need to find inner peace inside of ourselves, the need to remember Allah. There's actually a divine quest inside of a human being. Allah put that inside of us as a spiritual need. It's a light inside of us. There's a third dimension. So I've said physical needs, I've said spiritual needs, right? And then there's a third dimension, which is emotional needs. Emotional needs, right? And emotional needs are things like the need to feel safe, the need to feel loved, the need to feel accepted, the need to belong, the need to feel understood or to feel heard. Those are needs too, you know? The physical and the spiritual and the emotional. There are other needs too, like intellectual needs, for example, right? Or the needs for even material, not just spiritual purpose, higher purpose. Like somebody has a need to accomplish something. Somebody has a need to break a record, right? So there could be some need for accomplishment, whether it's intellectual accomplishment. I need to finish these 100 books. I need to learn these 5 new languages. Or I need to become the fastest runner, or whatever, right? Those are needs of accomplishment. Other animals don't share those needs, right? But anyway, so we've got these layers of needs, different departments of needs, right? What we have to understand is sometimes we have one of these needs and it starts affecting all the others. So I'll give you an example. You're hungry, which is a physical need, which starts affecting your mood, right? Starts affecting your mood, so it starts affecting you emotionally. So you're agitated and you're easily annoyed and you're quick to get angry or whatever because you're hangry, right? So now the physical started affecting the what? The emotional. Now you can't concentrate on your work or the book you were reading. So it also affected your intellectual needs. Now when you're praying, you can't concentrate in your prayer. It also affected you how? Spiritually. They're all connected sometimes. One affects the other. It's a domino effect. Now, they're still separate. They're still separate needs. But you have to identify what the problem, where did the problem come from? Which department has the problem? If you don't identify where the problem came from, you can't solve it. So if somebody's hungry and they can't concentrate in their prayer because they're thinking about a cheeseburger, and you say you need to do some spiritual exercises so you can concentrate better, no, you need to eat a burger, man. Just make sure it's halal. Eat that and then pray. So you're not thinking about food. That'll address your spiritual concern. You understand that? You're going to be able to do work better because now you don't have a hunger headache. Now you can concentrate on your reading. You can get ready for the test. If you don't identify where the problem came from, there's going to be a real problem. And you know what happens for Muslims, for us sometimes? We think every problem is spiritual. Every problem is spiritual. So if, for example, and this is the most common, somebody's depressed, or somebody has anxiety, or somebody has a panic attack, which is an emotional crisis. But we go to our religious leadership, or we go to somebody who we feel knows religion better than we do, and they say, this is a problem of you not having enough sabr, or you not having enough dhikr, or you not having enough salah, or you not, that may be a part of it, and that spiritual may have been affected because of their emotional state. Because remember, there's domino effect? But the problem is, you're trying to give them a spiritual solution, while the problem itself was what? Emotional. If you don't address the emotional problem, you may not ever be able to fix the spiritual problem because that wasn't the source. The spiritual was just falling because the emotional was falling. You fix the emotional, you try to heal the emotional, and the spiritual starts standing back up again too. the physical might start getting back up, because we know somebody's depressed or somebody's going through emotional trauma. They stop eating right. Their blood pressure goes up. They can start getting sick. All kinds of things. The body's connected like that. The human being, the body and the soul are connected in this way. Why am I telling you all of this? Because the Quran clearly makes a distinction between someone's emotional needs and their spiritual state. Emotionally, he needed to take precautions. Spiritually, he only relies on Allah. And those two separate departments can coexist. Allah put that need in him, so he fulfilled that need. Allah put that emotional need in him. And that need does not deny his spirituality. And that need does not deny his knowledge. إِنَّهُ لَذُو عِلْمٍ عَلَّمْنَاهُ. Those emotional needs does not mean you're not knowledgeable or you're just superstitious. It doesn't mean that. Those are separate departments, and you have to keep them in balance. And if you understand this picture, then you and I have to understand sometimes we're good at one of these. Like we're good at taking care of our physical needs, for example. You eat well, you do exercise, you have a good sleeping schedule, whatever. Like you're taking care of yourself physically. And that includes you're making good money, you're living in comfortable housing, you're safe, your clothing is, you know, all of that. That's your physical needs. But just because you're physically well doesn't mean your emotional needs, yours and others around you, are taken care of, which is kind of what I talked to you about with his sons. They may be providing for the household physically, but they're emotionally traumatic to their father, right? They're emotionally traumatic to him. So you and I have to become balanced individuals. Our religion is not telling us to be spiritual at the expense of our physical needs, at the expense of our emotional needs, at the expense of our intellectual needs, or even by an extension of emotional needs, even our social needs, our needs of human interaction. It's not stopping us from that. It's putting guidelines on it. And what our religion does so beautifully is not only does it give us a spiritual guideline on how to remember Allah and how to connect at a higher spiritual level, it gives us guidelines on how to balance our physical life, how to balance our emotional life, how to balance our social life, how to balance our a life of purpose, a life of work. That's why Allah will tell us what kinds of business transactions are haram. You can stay away from the haram. Now you have a balanced career life. That part of your life is in balance. Here are some things that you cannot do in your relationships. Here's how you take care of family matters. And a lot of your social and family and emotional matters are taken care of because you're providing basic rights and responsibilities. That's the basics are covered. So what our religion does is it provides this balanced picture. And what I feel strongly, growing up in the ummah and being exposed to khutbahs and talks and books and literature throughout our lives, I feel like we present the religion as purely spiritual, and every solution to every problem is purely spiritual, while the Quran itself doesn't do that. The Quran presents a more comprehensive picture of the human being and presents more comprehensive solutions for the human being, even when it comes to prophets, alayhimus salam. And this is an important thing, right? Just to give you another small glimpse of that, and I'll conclude for today. We know as believers spiritually that our honor comes from Allah. وَلَقَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمْ. We honored the children of Adam alayhi salam. And someone who believes in Allah knows their rizq comes from Allah, their dignity comes from Allah, their life belongs to Allah. It's all entirely up to Allah, yes? Maryam is an example of a woman who trusted Allah so much that when she would get fruits out of season, she would teach her uncle a thing or two about relying on Allah. When he would say, "Where did you get this?" she'd say, "This is from Allah. Allah provides whoever he wants out of season, بِغَيْرِ حِسَابٍ, without any reckoning." And then Allah says, "Oh, since you believe in fruit out of season, let me give you a fruit out of season." And he gives her Jesus. He gives her Isa alayhi salam. And she knows that Allah has honored her over all women, because the angels came and told her, وَاصْطَفَاكِ عَلَى نِسَاءِ الْعَالَمِينَ. He has chosen you over the women of all the nations, of all peoples. You are on top. This is the most honored woman. Among the highest of the angels, they're coming to let her know that Allah has honored her above all else, above all other females. Can there be a higher honor for a female? No. There cannot be. What kind of honor is this though? I need you to understand. Spiritual honor. She's spiritually honored by Allah. But when she has that baby, and she's going to go back, she's going to get emotionally wrecked by her own people. Yes or no? They're going to say the most vile things to her. Yes or no? They're going to humiliate her publicly, yes or no? And the trauma that hasn't even happened yet, but the emotional trauma of what is to come is so heavy for her. She says, the woman who's been honored more than anyone else and already knows that, says, Ya laytani mittu qabla hadha wa kuntu nasiya mansiya. If only I could die before this happens. If only I could be forgotten completely. Nasiyan mansiya. Forgotten on top of forgotten suggests nobody would even, not only am I forgotten, there's no record of me or no trace of me. I could just completely vanish, please, if I could just vanish. Why? Because she's terrified of the emotional need for holding on to your dignity before people. That's going to be ripped away from me. Right? And I don't want to exist if that's not there. Even though spiritually, her highest needs have been met. More than any other female ever, actually. Isn't that the case? So what am I trying to get at? You could have the most beautiful spiritual relationship with Allah, but that is not a compensation for your emotional needs, your physical needs, your social needs. Those needs remain because we're still human. We're still human. And this is something Allah is teaching us in the remarkable example of Yaqub alayhi salam. Illa hajatan fi nafsi Yusufa, fi nafsi Yaquba qadaha. This except he told them to go from different doors because he felt a need inside himself that he had to fulfill. He fulfilled it. Qadaha. He did justice to the need that he had. And Allah did not criticize him for doing so. In fact, said, and he had profound knowledge. He understood what belongs in what department. And he understood sometimes our emotions can make us forget our spiritual relationship with Allah. So even though emotionally I have a need, spiritually I know that only Allah can protect. So he kept that balance. And most people don't keep that balance. They become either people of only spirituality or people of only emotion. I do whatever feels right. I don't care what Allah says. People sway, right? That's why Allah says at the end, perhaps, and however, most people don't know. Most people don't know this balance. May Allah Azza wa Jalla make us people of this remarkable balance. Again, inshallah, we're going to have some further conversations about the evil eye and its effects and the reality behind it and the narration surrounding it. And inshallah ta'ala, have a fruitful conversation that benefits everybody from it. Barakallahu li wa lakum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.